happens in the U.S. during Trump or even before that, what happens to minors and what happens to minorities and people of color, and how the authorities are treating them, how the police forces are treating them, we can get the picture very clear here. They have a free hand. You know, the interrogators, the police forces, the soldiers here have a free hand because they have a cover-up. And who is covering up their terrorizing and their criminal acts against Palestinian minors, women, old people? They have nothing, actually, to stop them because the U.S. is backing them up. And the rest of the NATO countries, the rest of the allied forces, which are led by the U.S., is defending them. The U.N., actually, and international human rights has piles of cases that shows and is a solid evidence of crimes that has been committed against minors, which do not get anywhere. All these reports, all these statistics that are sitting in the, you know, in the drawers and offices of the UN human rights offices, do not get any legal, legal follow-up in order to put an end to these violations of human rights and violations of international law. So Israel goes, you know, unpunished, unaccountable for all its crimes, killing youth, actually keeping the bodies of the martyrs of Palestinian children. Until now, we have like more than 50 bodies of children who have been martyred in 2015. And the families cannot get their, their bodies to...
There are a lot of scandals affiliated with these cases, with a lot of them being organ trafficking by the Israeli entity. But these practices leave the occupation forces, as you said, free to pressure to the kids, the families, and to make them confess. And indeed, at some point, some kids actually sign involuntarily confessions, which are used basically. They are written in a different language than that they know, and they are obviously false ones, but the kids are intimidated to do so, which are then used as a basis of indictments against these kids, which could actually lead them to be behind bars for more than 20 years, according to the age of the kid. But why bear all this cost? I mean, they're definitely paying a lot of money to do this. Why are they bearing all this cost? I mean, what young kids are confessing to crimes that they have nothing to do with? What are the Israelis actually achieving by this specific act of intimidation and terrorism?
Actually, they want to terrorize and intimidate the kids so they don't throw stones. That's the major, you know, the major accusations that they use against these kids. Because what else do they have except for throwing stones at the soldiers when they, when they barge in into their homes or into their villages or into their olive yard fields? That's the only thing that they have. They want to defend themselves from the assaults of these soldiers or settlers. In this case, it's during this last, during this season of olive picking, so many people have been, documented as being targeted by settlers and by soldiers. And hundreds of trees has been uprooted or burned while the people are trying to protect it. But, of course, they can't do much. And confession by kids during interrogations is very famous for the past, like, 4 or 5 decades. Mm-hmm. They try to use this to force kids because, of course, they want to close the case and send them to prison. But with throwing stones, no, I don't think that there is any charge in the whole world that puts kids behind bars for throwing a stone. But of course, they fabricate allegations and accusations against these you know, peaceful kids who are trying to defend their olive fields or mm-hmm. trying to defend their fathers while they the soldiers trying to arrest their fathers. So these criminal acts or war crimes and crimes against humanity that are committed by the Israelis are not being accountable and not being addressed by the ICC, for example. Mm-hmm. Because to go to this court, you need years and years, and with lots of evidence, especially with martyrs, for example. We, in our case, our foundation, Sheikh Hassan Foundation, has been following some cases of martyrdom or even severe wounds by the Israeli soldiers, and it doesn't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. It stays there.
It basically starts with the fact that Israel actually does not. It starts with the fact that Israel does not even recognize the ICC, for that matter, or any other international community, if you will, body, which I hate that word, by the way. It's just a couple of countries in the West deciding over what happens in our region, especially in occupied Palestine. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, for speaking to us about the horrific incidents that the young people of Palestine, the youth of Palestine, is going through because of the Israeli occupation forces. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will talk about Lebanon. Now, as the efforts to form a Lebanese government headed by Saad al-Hariri falter, the media silence regarding the government formation directly and openly between the president of the country, Michel Aoun, and the prime minister designate Saad al-Hariri has changed from a positive issue in terms of preventing confusions to a negative issue after several weeks had passed without any hopeful signs emerging as gossip, rumors and misinformation multiplied without any clarifications being issued by those involved in the pressing file of government formation. Hariri stuck in government formation in Lebanon in this following report. Lebanon is currently experiencing a gradual deterioration towards the abyss in light of its political stalemate, financial and economic hardships, and the lack of a support program from the international community as the required reforms have not yet been achieved. November 19 last week saw a sudden increase in the dollar exchange rate, which reached 8,200 Lebanese pounds on the black market before dropping slightly. The rate had dropped to under 7,000 Lebanese pounds less than a month ago when Saad al-Hariri was assigned to form a new government based on the French Rescue Initiative on October 22nd. However, that has yet to happen, with the efforts to form a Lebanese government headed by Saad al-Hariri faltered so far. Several factors have been influencing this trend. However, it is the external interference that is lock-jamming any political development in Lebanon, especially after the new U.S. sanctions imposed against the head of the Free Patriotic Movement, former Minister Gibran Basil, beginning with the continuous U.S. pressure on every prime minister designate so far to limit their representation of Hezbollah in the government formation process and to deny it ministerial positions despite the fact that Hezbollah has the majority in the Lebanese parliament. Add to that the external influence in the form of continuous Arab and Gulf messages to Hariri, making it clear to him that there will be no change in the currently adopted policy towards Lebanon and therefore no aid unless there is a change in the Lebanese government's dealing with Arab and Persian Gulf files. Mind you, all the while, the international community is also warning that Lebanon will not receive any kind of aid and financial loans unless it forms a new government that is trusted internally and internationally and is particularly capable of launching the much-needed reform workshop on various levels. Faced with this reality, Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri is between a rock and a hard place. He feels obliged to succumb to external pressure while the internal political demands puts the future of the entire country on the line. A decisive week ahead for Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, he either fails to form a government or he will form one that resembles its predecessors in both form and terms of power and lose all foreign support. Now with us to discuss this issue from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, who is an academic and a writer. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nashabi. Now, observers of the Lebanese political dilemma believe that the external influence in the form of continuous U.S. pressure on Lebanon would be the main reason behind why Saad al-Hariri has failed so far to formulate a government, specifically as far as the U.S. openly aiming to limit the representation of Hezbollah and any of their allies at this point in the executive authority, and to deny them what they call sensitive ministries, whatever that means. If that's the case, then can we say that actually there's no hope for anyone, even it's Hariri himself, to actually formulate a government in Lebanon with these pressures on the table?
Yes, well, unfortunately, amidst the crisis that we're going through in Lebanon, the economic crisis, the spread of the COVID-19 virus and the port explosion, amidst all this, I feel that, yes, there's a lot of international pressure and international interference in Lebanese affairs. In fact, the only initiative to move forward is a French initiative, not even a local one. And Mr. Hariri was designated as prime minister. He's finding it, he's having a lot of difficulties to form the government because there are demands apparently by foreign powers that are pressuring him not to have, Hezbollah represented in the government. Well, I think that what I heard in the recent days in Beirut is that there is no problem. This issue can be resolved easily. Hezbollah does not have to have ministers from its, party members. As members of parliament, we have to remember that Hezbollah is a party represented in parliament. So many people who voted for Hezbollah are not necessarily Hezbollah party members. Mm-hmm. So there are many supporters of Hezbollah who are not party members and who are not directly linked to Hezbollah, and they can be represented in the government. Now, this is making it more difficult for some Western powers that are pressuring for to deprive any representation of anyone who supports the resistance in the government. That's mm-hmm. practically impossible. So yes, there is a problem and there is a complicated situation here. There's a lot of external pressure, and Mr. Hariri perhaps doesn't have the actual power or the position to take a strong stance and refuse these or reject these external pressures on him, apparently.
We would add maybe more a bit to the external U.S. pressure, also to the pressure from the European countries, from the international community, to be honest with you, because they keep pressuring Lebanon, telling them that you will receive no aid, no financial loans whatsoever unless there's a government formed and unless that government is trusted both internally and internationally. I don't know why should be trusted internationally, but in particularly capable of launching what they call the reform workshop on various level. So it seems like one huge loop of inaction here. I mean, honestly, what options does Saad al-Hariri have at the moment as the country actually is heading to a financial disaster?
Yes, he has one main way to go forward if he wants to go forward or if he has the capacity to go forward, and that's a democratic process. There is a system in Lebanon. There's a constitution. And the prime minister, before forming the government, according to the constitution, has to do consultations with the various political groups and various coalitions in parliament and form the president based on their recommendations. Their recommendations are on the table. He knows the recommendations, and therefore he's supposed to form a government based on the constitutional process. If he doesn't do that, he can actually face these European and Western powers by telling them, would you like a democratic process in Lebanon or a dictatorship? Now here is the situation. He puts them on the spot by mm-hmm. saying, if you would like to have a democratic process, Hezbollah is a party that was voted in Lebanon democratically. They were European observers at that time when the elections took place. So therefore, Hezbollah is representative of the people. I mean, if you don't like Hezbollah, you have to change people's votes. So maybe you can change the people's choices in the next elections. That's a different process. But
yes,
for now,
they've been doing this the wrong way by sanctioning the entire country.
Spending,
but let us dive a bit into the major internal difficulties here that's happening between certain parties and the prime minister designate, especially talking about the struggle between the Future Movement, which is head by prime minister designate Hariri, and the Free Patriotic Movement led by former minister Jibran Bassir.
Well,
feud about?
Well, I feel part of this kind of confrontation between the Future Movement and the Free Patriotic Movement is about power sharing. I mean, you know, this is what we say in Lebanon, is that the country, one of the biggest flaws in the system, in the government system in this country, is that it's based on power sharing between the various communities, between Sunni Muslims and the Maronite Christians and Shia Muslims. And
sectarian this, power
sectarian
sharing.
Sectarian power sharing. And that sectarian religious power sharing does not actually constitute as a solid grounds for building a nation that is capable of having all the mechanisms of accountability activated, because the mechanisms of accountability cannot allow some people who are doing corruption to hide behind their confessional identity, you know, and that's what's happening in Lebanon. So they're doing this the sharing between the various religious sectarian groups, and that does not build solid grounds for moving forward. I mean, and like Sayyid Abbas Mousawi said in the 90s, when the Taif agreement was passed, Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, who was the martyr,
he warned
that the Taif agreement, since it is based, the constitution amendments that were done in the 90s, since they're based on power sharing by the different religious and sectarian groups, they will actually lead to more problems and reach more disagreements between the various sectarian groups.
But one also something that's interesting, that we have less than 2 minutes here, that I heard last week was from the UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon, John Kubis, who lamented the absence of functioning government in the country, especially in the aftermath of the deadly August 4th explosion. But he said that he had briefed the UN Security Council about the lack of progress in Lebanon. I mean, hold on a second. What does he mean? I mean, first of all, in what position is he to start giving such reports to the UNSC? That's one. And number two, is he basically signaling for a possible more role for the UN by the UNIFIL that are on the ground in Lebanon? That's very dangerous.
I don't think so. I think that maybe what we would like him to be meaning, I hope that he means the Security Council Resolution 242, 339, 194. These are Security Council resolutions that have to apply and that Israel has been violating for so long. Israel is the entity that has been violating international law more than any other entity in the whole region. So therefore, to actually talk about Security Council resolution...
What if he means the 1701, though?
Well, yes, let's... Okay, 1701 came
resolution.
After. I think we should go in line. 242, 338, 194 are resolutions that have been violated for more than three decades. So I think it is about time for these resolutions to start applying these resolutions, and then all the other resolutions will follow, and it wouldn't be necessary. Actually, I have to say something at the end, is that there wouldn't be any armed resistance if there was no
occupation. And aggression.
Exactly.
We still are not being able to implement the 425 resolution up until
425
now.
Was applied by the force of the resistance,
exactly,
according to chapter 7, right
to
resist.
Not fully, if I may. We still have countryside villages that are still occupied. I want to thank you very much for
this
very, very uplifting, first of all, conversation with you, Dr. Omar Nashebi, and hopeful for an upcoming government, if it might be happening in Beirut, to try and salvage what's left of the economy and the financial institutions in the country. Thank you very much for being with us, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Dr. Helen Yaff of Glasgow University, author of We Are Cuba, How a Revolutionary People Have Survived in a Post-Soviet World, said, Cuba now has four COVID-specific vaccine candidates under clinical trial. The fact that a small Caribbean island can achieve such a remarkable feat is testimony to its state-owned biotech sector, which is directed towards public health demands and integrated into its healthcare and education systems. After years of being told that only the market can lead to efficiency and innovation, Cuba's socialist planned economy demonstrates what is possible when there is political will, good coordination, organization, and the priority of social welfare. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alan McLeod, staff writer of Mint Press News, under the heading, Cuba could be on the brink of a revolutionary COVID vaccine, but U.S. sanctions are slowing it down. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. Cuba has announced positive and promising results for a number of separate COVID-19 vaccines it is currently developing. But U.S. sanctions against the small island nation are hampering the development and rollout of the potentially life-saving treatments. Two candidates named Sovereign 1 and Sovereign 2 have generated antibodies blocking infection in animals and are showing similarly encouraging signs on tests on human subjects. Meanwhile, a separate vaccine based on a protein from the hepatitis B virus is unique in that it is delivered through the nasal tract and does not require a needle to administer. Should any of these efforts ultimately succeed, the Caribbean nation, already a medical powerhouse that has developed a long cancer vaccine and methods to stop mother-to-baby HIV and syphilis transmission, will likely become an important supplier to other Latin American and developing countries who have been effectively shut out from purchasing COVID vaccines from Western companies, as rich nations have already begun hoarding coronavirus medicines. Dr. Helen Yaff of Glasgow University, author of We Are Cuba, How a Revolutionary People Have Survived in a Post-Soviet World, was impressed and heartened by the news, telling Mint Press, Cuba now has four COVID-specific vaccine candidates under clinical trial. The fact that a small Caribbean island can achieve such a remarkable feat is testimony to its state-owned biotech sector, which is directed toward public health demands and integrated into its healthcare and education systems. After years of being told that only the market can lead to efficiency and innovation, Cuba's socialist planned economy demonstrates what is possible when there is political will, good coordination, organization, and the priority of social welfare. However, Cuban immunization developments are being seriously hamstrung by the actions of the U.S. government, primarily due to the decades-long blockade on the island, something which the Cuban government estimates has cost it over $750 billion. As Reuters reported, cash-strapped Cuba cannot afford to buy the raw materials necessary to upscale its vaccine development to help other countries. Hospitals face huge obstacles importing life-saving equipment from abroad due to the blockade, while the sanctions force the country, which imports the large majority of its staples, to spend far more on food than other nations. As a result, according to the World Food Program, almost one-third of young children suffer from anemia due to the monotonous and subpar nutrition available. Food production is hampered. With little petroleum available for agriculture, the country instead went back to rely on human or animal labor. The blockade also led to the forced development of a domestic pharmaceutical and biotechnology sector, which has grown to become among the most advanced in the world. Last November, the United Nations voted 187-3 in favor of ending the blockade, with the U.S., the Zionist regime, and Brazil voting no. Almost two-thirds of Americans support an end to the action as well. Despite this, the Trump administration has in fact intensified the pressure on Cuba, as Dr. Yaff explained. Cuba has been subject to an additional 46 sanctions and new measures to tighten the blockade, to scare off foreign investors, to create a scarcity, to create difficulty for Cuba to access raw materials, including for its biotech sector and for its pharmaceutical industry. Yaf notes in her new documentary entitled Cuba and COVID-19, Public Health, Science and Solidarity, one example of this is that the island can no longer purchase ventilators or parts for existing machines because the Swiss company it dealt with was purchased by an American one, and fearing potential reprisals, it halted any contact with Havana. A more positive but nevertheless difficult challenge the Cuban government faces in testing its new vaccines is the lack of COVID-19 patients on the island, which has the highest proportion of medical professionals per capita anywhere in the world. To date, the country has recorded only 7,639 cases and 131 deaths. U.S.-backed conservative neighbors such as Brazil, Ecuador, and until recent weeks, Bolivia, that had expelled Cuban doctors working inside their borders, have fared far worse. Under Trump, the U.S. also led the world in the theft of medical equipment and personal protective gear, confiscating shipments and diverting supplies away from other countries to keep for itself. And at the height of the outbreak in Iran, the government was unable to buy or import life-saving gear due to cruel American sanctions, as no nation was willing to risk the wrath of hawkish Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who threatened harsh sanctions on anyone willing to do business with Iran. Finally, the World Health Organization directly intervened, gifting Iran supplies, sparking the Trump administration to leave WHO, among other reasons. The U.S., along with other wealthy nations, has also been quietly buying up the majority of any future supply of vaccines, concerning the market and leaving little hope for developing nations to secure their own supply of vaccines. The for-profit corporations conducting their research have made it clear that they intend to withhold production secrets in order to cash in. Furthermore, they do not have the capacity to immunize the entire world. For example, the U.S. German company predicts that it could supply enough for only around 650 million people by the end of 2021. This is why the development of treatments outside the for-profit model is so important. Recently, Pfizer claimed that its own trial, featuring over 43,000 people in six countries, was a success with a 90% immunization rate and only 94 people contracting the virus from the vaccine. Massachusetts-based Moderna claims that its vaccine is even more effective with a 94% immunization rate and does not have to be stored at 80 degrees centigrade temperature like Pfizer offering. The first country to announce a potential vaccine was Russia, however. The government sharing the news in September with researchers saying Sputnik V was 90% effective and that Russia could produce 500 million doses annually. The Russian and American offerings appear to be based upon the same scientific logic and have produced broadly similar results. However, the Russian vaccine has been near universally panned in the Western press, while the American ones heralded as a historic achievement. Thus, Sky News headline described Pfizer breakthrough as a great day for science and humanity, while casting doubt on the validity of Sputnik V, claiming the Russian secretive approach is a throwback to its spirit in the Cold War. Regardless if any or all of the treatments work, the world will need a sustained, a coordinated international effort to immunize itself against COVID-19, as no one company can possibly supply the entire planet. By continuing the blockade against Cuba, the U.S. government might be condemning much of the world to living months longer under a deadly pandemic that has claimed the lives of over 1.32 million people.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. 39 Afghan civilians who were killed in 2002 are most likely to have been killed illegally by Australian Special Forces. Now, this is according to a four-year investigation by Australian Defence Force after complaints by Afghan and Australian nationals to investigate. So what does it all mean now? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
The Australian military is under fire following the release of a damning report this week that has found credible evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. The long-awaited report, based on a four-year inquiry, has found evidence that Australian Special Forces killed dozens of Afghan prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. The findings of the inquiry, carried out by the Australian Defence Force, reveal a twisted and extreme warrior culture among the elite of the Australian armed forces who were deployed to Afghanistan. The commandos were supposed to fight militants thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but many of them now stand accused of engaging in a methodical campaign to kill unarmed Afghans and conceal it. In one instance, the inquiry has found evidence that platoon commanders told junior soldiers to get their first kill by shooting prisoners. An academic who carried out initial research into the atrocities believes that they were, quote, deliberate, repeated, and targeted war crimes. The inquiry findings show that some of the soldiers who are accused of committing these war crimes are still serving in the Australian military. The report has been highly redacted, and many details of the atrocities remain unknown. But its authors have admitted that they probably failed to uncover all crimes committed during a period of time under investigation. They have recommended a mechanism to collect and assess further allegations of atrocities in Afghanistan. The findings are deeply embarrassing for the Australian government, which is a vociferous critic of rights abuses around the world. The government initially tried to suppress whistleblowers and local media that had tried to bring the alleged war crimes to public attention. Australian authorities tried hard to keep a lid on this story when it first emerged in 2017. That year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation published shocking allegations of unlawful killings of unarmed Afghans, including children, based on leaked military documents. The Australian Federal Police raided the office of the national broadcaster and tried in vain to prosecute the journalist who blew the whistle on the killings. The story now seems to have turned into a major scandal. The latest findings are a painful legacy of America's longest war. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 has resulted in nearly two decades of war. A very large number of Afghan civilians, including children, have lost their lives in American and U.S.-led airstrikes and operations. The U.S.-led military campaign has failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with an endless list of problems. The United States itself is being investigated for possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The ICC probe began earlier this year after a preliminary report found reasons to believe war crimes had been committed during the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who was infuriated by the investigation, imposed sanctions on the court. His decision drew worldwide condemnation. Observers believe that the U.S. must have a lot to worry about as the International Criminal Court investigates its actions during the war in Afghanistan.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London and journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. Thanks so much for being with us. Let's start off in London with Jonathan. What did you think about the findings of this investigation, and were you surprised at all that these type of abuses had taken place?
Obviously, the reports are very shocking indeed, even though it was somewhat redacted. There's enough information in there to really raise huge questions over the whole nature of the operations of the special forces of the Australian Army in Afghanistan. The good thing is the report has come out, and also that the head of the Defence Services has apologised. But of course, an apology is nothing like enough. There will be prosecutions, and that must be prosecutions. But it shouldn't only be the younger soldiers who end up being prosecuted, because I think clearly the command chain goes higher, including perhaps into the political sphere of the leadership in Australia. And there needs to be a very, very careful investigation as to exactly how this sort of policy came about, where, as was mentioned in the introductory piece, for example, there would be what was called blooding. Young recruits just arriving would be told to shoot a prisoner in order to get them used to killing civilians, which is clearly a war crime.
Well, Brett, in the report it states about that war culture that our guest in London just was mentioning amongst these elite troops, and the way some troops were anxious to get their first kill. And what exactly does that say? I mean, does it appear to you that this would just be something isolated, and these troops were not following orders? Do you think this is just isolated with these individuals, or do you think that the responsibility goes further up the ladder?
I think it definitely runs further than just the rank and file troops that have committed these atrocities. Indeed, as has been mentioned and as was written in the report, in many cases these were initiation rituals of a kind. You know, young soldiers, grunts who come into combat for the first time, who are being told to basically get their hands dirty immediately in one of the most gruesome ways possible by murdering either civilians or unarmed prisoners. And of course, this order had to come from someone. And so this order came most likely from the officers. And the officer staff, of course, responds to an even higher brass of higher officers and higher ups. That I think it's very unlikely, if this was such a relatively commonplace occurrence, as seems to be hinted in the report, it would be very unlikely that the higher brass did not know about this, and that the military leadership was in the dark about this. I think this is, on the contrary, this speaks to a very typical and very problematic culture of extreme nationalism and jingoism in not just Australia, and not Australia in particular even, but in the Western armed forces that have been active in the Middle East in general and in Central Asia in the past few decades. This is a typical sort of mentality that you see also expressed in the United States military, I believe also in the British military, and in many of the troops that and armies in general, army command structures of the nations that are active in the conflict in, for example, Afghanistan, but also in Iraq. Because what you see is a form of result, what I would call a result of decades of massive propaganda, of dehumanization of the enemy, and not just of the enemy, but of the people living in the country. Mm-hmm. This is no longer crimes committed against people who fought necessarily against this these troops. These are not just Taliban soldiers or Daesh or whatever extremists that are being targeted. These are very often civilians. There have been numerous cases of footage being published in which soldiers, usually American soldiers, are traveling through the countryside in Afghanistan and just murdered some farmers or some goat herders or shepherds along the way, because they know that there is very little chance of this really going viral, let's say, because for them these are just illiterate peasants that they mm-hmm. can do with whatever they want. This is a problem of mentality, a problem of mindset,
okay,
that's all pervasive in the military structure of many Western societies.
What about that, Jonathan? I mean, do you think in general this U.S.-led coalition, and in this case we're talking about the Australian side of things, but in general that, as our other guest was alluding to, that they have this superiority type of attitude when dealing with the other, especially, for example, dealing with Afghans, and basically not even looking at these people as human sometimes?
Yes, I'm sure that's right. Brett is absolutely correct to focus on the dehumanization of the other in these sorts of conflict situations. The fact that they're of different ethnicity, the fact that they are Muslims in most cases, also plays into this narrative of some countries, including the United States, that see them therefore as the enemy, whether they are actually armed resistance or terrorists or just ordinary farmers going about their own business. And there seems to have been such an acceptance of that situation in Afghanistan, by no means only by the Australians, that poor Afghans who were confronted with these sorts of situations often didn't even complain because they thought it would be a complete waste of time, that there was a culture of impunity, and the well-armed Westerners, whether they were Australians, Americans, or indeed British, would always be able to have their way, and that the best way to escape problems was to remain quiet and out of sight. So there is a real problem, and it's not only in Afghanistan. We saw incidents like that in Iraq as well. For example, the way that Americans treated people in Abu Ghraib prison, you may recall, appalling scenes of degradation and dehumanization. And this is something that really Western countries, including Britain, have got to come to terms with and to stamp out.
Well, Brett, the acts that, actually crimes that we're talking about happened 18 years ago. Why do you think it's taken so long to expose this when Afghan families have been complaining from the very beginning about the abuses of U.S.-led coalition forces there?
Well, I think it's a combination of general problems, of course, getting information like this out to the world, but combined with a far more important and far more destructive problem, being the policy of keeping a lid on everything. As has been said in the beginning of the report, indeed, by the reporter on the scene, is that when ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, reported on this in 2017 in the first place, their offices were raided, and the journalist was for a while threatened basically to be treated as, for example, Julian Assange or Edward Snowden were when they basically blew a whistle on certain crimes that were being committed in the country or by people of the country's nationality. So this is, when you see that this is how far they will go in broad daylight in Australia already, you can only begin to imagine how far they will go in order to keep this under, to swipe this under the rug when it's being said in Afghanistan. You can imagine if a farmer or a shepherd in Afghanistan goes to complain to the authorities, to the police forces, even if it's the Afghan local authorities, the chances are very high, of course, that this complaint will be noticed by the occupying forces, the foreign forces that are being talked about, in this case, the Australians. So, of course, there is no evidence of a violent crackdown on people who are trying to explain their story. But I don't think it would be very far-fetched to believe that these people are likely threatened with violence, threatened with more dangerous acts if they try to get their story known. And indeed, as Mr. Fryer said, the problem is that many of these people, after a while, probably just gave up trying to complain about it in general, because what's the point of trying to get your story out if you know the lid will be trying to, they will try to put the lid on it constantly. And that the result is that, fortunately, we have had some good journalists now, Australian journalists, who have finally decided to publish the story. But it will, of course, it has taken years for these people to dig through the mud in order to get what they needed in order to publish this report. That's the result of it.
Right. And Jonathan, at the end of the day, do you think that any measures will really be taken against these soldiers? Will these soldiers be charged with murder, you think?
Well, I think certainly there will be prosecutions, whether they will be found guilty and sentenced to long periods of prison is another matter. But I think there certainly will be prosecutions. It would be very difficult for the Australian government to avoid putting some troops on trial because of the public opinion and international opinion, which would demand that some people have to bear responsibility. But as I mentioned earlier, the problem is how high up the line should this go? Because obviously the higher it goes, then the less likelihood there is of any proper retribution against the people who are responsible for the policy, which does stem into the whole of the war of terror, war on terror narrative. In other words, that if you're in a situation where you're dealing against with terrorists, that anything goes, and that means that ordinary civilians who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with any extreme group get caught up in this. So I think it's very important for international law that Australia takes a stand, and that other countries, including Britain, also look at their own special forces and really see whether this problem is wider and whether how it can be rooted out.
Well, Brett, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has apologized directly to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani about what he called these abuses. But what does that mean at the end of the day? What do you think is going to happen?
Of course, the problem is that it's very easy to apologize for something that happened. The question here is, of course, if you not just, you know, talk the talk, but also walk the walk. And that's something that Australia has to prove now. They have to show to the world that they take this seriously, that these people will be tried for the crimes that they have committed. And indeed, this in many cases, this would definitely include the charge of murder or at least manslaughter, and not just, you know, crimes that not just like abuses that were committed in the time of war, because that makes it sound like there are circumstances that would justify these actions. And I don't think these things are justifiable, no matter under which circumstances they happen. The other problem, of course, is the question remains how far Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, will go in order to pursue this, because we have seen time and again that the Afghan government is not always necessarily a stable government, and is in many cases and in many ways very dependent, of course, on these foreign troops that are keeping it in power. There is very often a problem of popular support that is very much lacking popular support for this government. And as a result, it is very difficult, I think, for the it is very unlikely, I mean, for to hope that these Afghan politicians will really try to pressure what they perceive as their Western allies into really pursuing this very much. Of course, I could be mistaken, and I hope I will be. But this goes much further than just apologizing and saying sorry that this happened. These people have to be brought to justice. Recompensation should be paid to the families of the victims. And in general, actually, recompensation should be paid to Afghanistan, because this is running into their hundreds of billions of dollars that Afghanistan has been suffering in both economic terms and, of course, in manpower and in population. A lot of people that have been massacred as a result of this unnecessary war ever since 2001. Mm-hmm. So this is a general problem that has to be solved in a way that is much more fundamental. And that is something in which I fear that is unlikely to happen, because if we bring it back to the leader of this coalition, the United States, we have to bear in mind the United States has never even recompensated Vietnam for the crimes they have committed there 40, 50 years ago. So right. the chances that they could do this anytime soon to Afghanistan are, I'm afraid, quite slim.
Well, Jonathan, are there double standards in the way U.S. allies are held responsible for war crimes, as opposed to those fighting against the U.S.?
Well, I mean, a war crime is a war crime, whoever carries it out, whether it's the U.S. or any of their allied forces in a country like Afghanistan, or any extremist group. In the news bulletin, you mentioned today's attacks from Daesh on Kabul, again, yet more civilians killed in that attack. And certainly, they need to be held to account as well, but it's much more difficult because, of course, you can't often identify where is the chain of command and who are really carrying out these atrocities. But the whole idea of setting up the International Criminal Court several years ago, which Trump so dislikes, is the idea that there are international standards, and these should apply to governments, to armies, and to non-state actors. And it's very important, I think, that this principle be bolstered by appropriate judicial action, and that the climate of impunity in a war situation is removed, because surely in the 21st century we should have realized that it's no longer possible to justify many things which perhaps our ancestors considered perfectly normal, but which we don't.
Which we don't. What do you think about that, Brett? Things that ancestors didn't consider normal, but which we don't. However, if we look at the world of 2020 and we see the imbalance of it all, how much have we progressed? When we look at this situation, at the end of the day, don't you think, according to international standards, that the life of an Afghan is not going to be held the same as for as an American soldier being killed, or an Aussie soldier being killed, or a Brit being killed on the ground? Isn't there a difference when we see terrorist attacks and how we react when they're committed in Afghanistan as opposed to a terrorist attack in Europe or some of these other Western countries?
Yeah, this is, I believe that is undeniably true. There is a massive amount of hypocrisy in general, in international media, mainstream media mostly, in international politics. Even in international diplomacy, there is a massive issue that we have, what we have seen over and over again, that when a terrorist attack happens, for example, in Brussels or in Paris, this is worldwide news, this goes on that to dominate world politics for years sometimes, whereas these sort of attacks that have been taking place, for example, in Paris, they happen on a weekly basis in some areas in the Middle East, for example, and in many cases those same sort of attacks of that magnitude are being committed by the Western powers that are mourning the attacks that are taking place in the West. Now, the problem is that there is this indeed this massive double standard that unfortunately has seeped very much into the ICC as well. The ICC has been doing definitely some good work ever since it was founded, undeniably so. But there is as well an undeniable focus on certain third world leaders and certain third world countries. There is a reason why in some regions of Africa, the ICC is jokingly called the International Caucasian Court, because it's something that it's a court that is perceived as a very Eurocentric court that specifically targets leaders of in Africa mostly, or in Yugoslavia, be leaders of third world countries, of countries that are not part of the hegemonic powers, and that these people, for their crimes or perceived crimes, are being dragged to The Hague in order to be tried. But it's very almost unheard of to see this pressure, the same sort of status, the same sort of rules being applied to people and rulers of first world countries. For example, you know, George W. Bush. For example, the crimes committed by President Obama, who even received the Nobel Peace Prize right before he went on to, you know, murder people in Syria and in Libya. So this is there is a massive hypocrisy at play here that is embedded in a way, of course, in the United Nations, very often in the veto power being wielded by certain permanent members of the Security Council.
All right. And on that note, so sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us.